Welcome to the Linux Lugcast, episode 107. We're an open podcast log that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. If you'd like to join us, please visit linuxlugcast.com for the server details. We also have a Mumble how-to on the site explaining how to configure Mumble. Then just join us in Linux Lugcast room during the live in the Linux Lugcast room during the live show. If you're unable to join us in Mumble, you can listen to us streaming live. You can also join us in IRC on Freenode, Pound Linux Lugcast. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like us to discuss, please email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com. We also have a Google Plus community site, a mailing list, and visit our website for the direct links. And again, I think that's somewhat true. We have to edit that. I haven't got the mailing list up back up yet, and we have to talk to Father Finch about and Kevin Mosher about what's going on with the stream. I think when things got switched over, because I had to redirect some stuff that might have screwed up the stream process, but I don't know for sure. I am your host for this evening, Honky Magoo. With me tonight is 5150.
Howdy, folks.
And Netminer.
Hello, friend.
To get it out of the way, how's everybody feeling?
Fine. I am off the oxygen since Monday of last week. I think I sort of amazed my general practitioner. I finally got in to see him. And I said, you know, really, times that I've been away from the oxygen, there have been a couple times, I've been off it for a while. And I said, you know, and I check my oxygen level, and it's still pretty high. So, in fact, it may be too high. I talked to someone else who's on oxygen and said, yeah, you could, that also brings up your CO2 levels. So, there's actually medication to bring that down. So, I may have to, didn't get around to it today. Next week, call the doctor's nurse and ask if that's something I ought to really be good about, because it's like 98%. And I don't want to go in the whole medical thing like I did last time. But the thing is, I'm no longer tethered to oxygen. I'm walking around, feel pretty much normal. Doctor did tell me it would be several months before all the blood clots were dissolved, but apparently I'm getting as much oxygen as I need, at least for normal activities. I don't know if I want to go run a sprint or anything like that, or go chase cattle and jump over panels or whatever. But for normal around the house stuff, going to town, I've been driving, it's not a problem, and not having to drag around oxygen has been an incredible amount of freedom. So thank you for asking.
And that minor, right. I was going to say, go ahead.
I'm doing all right. As I said to a friend, I'm somewhere between roast and broil up here in the Boston area. According to my little XFCE widget, the temperature is 75 and the effective temperature is 91.
Yeah, that's probably what. One of the good things about working in a refrigerator all day is I really don't notice the heat as much.
Yeah, I try to stay out of it, but it hadn't consistent. We've had, we'll have one day 3-digit temperatures, and the next day it's 75.
We've also been blessed with this new house having central air.
Guess I'm lucky. The other day the hearse didn't boil over. I went, to Wichita, 70 miles away on probably one of the hottest days we've had this summer, and then I took it into the shop get the compressor replaced, and I had the AC on. It was working that day, but didn't work the next day. Must have had a leak in there, which the guy, when he sold it to me, I'm sure he must have known about and filled it up the day before, but so it would appear to work. But, for what I paid for it, I'm not worried about that. But got it in the shop and is about ready to come back. And when they were testing the air conditioner, I said, oh, we got a leak in the in the radiator. And of course, you can't get anybody to work on a radiator anymore. They just had to buy a whole new one and put it in. But I guess it must have been just a drip, because I'm surprised. I would have thought I would have given it pretty much about as big a stress test on overheating as I could have that day.
And you do need to paint it white and call it Ecto One.
Oh, I like the paint scheme on it too well for that. If it was ratty or something like that, and I need to repaint it anyway, I would. But no, I'm not doing that though. I am looking for, if anybody knows of a Ecto One siren out there. I did look on Amazon. And I thought, oh great, $18, I can get an Ecto One siren. Well, that apparently is for toy cars. So there's another one on there. It's just like a general siren thing that has two options, and one of them is the Ghostbuster siren, but it's more like $200. So I'm looking around for my best option on that. So if anybody in the listening audience has ever, you know, for some reason done that and has something they can recommend, or, you know, maybe somebody has, you know, a solution with a microcomputer like a Raspberry Pi and a speaker, or a loudspeaker under the hood, something like that. I was thinking about, surely there must be a roll your own solution out there someplace. So if anybody's come across an article like that mailed into the show.
Yeah, there's got to be something with, like you said, a speaker and a single board computer or something. Even if just a speaker that's hooked up to the regular audio system, that you just kind of flip a switch and it kind of pumps it out, you know, your audio out to the speaker as well to the speakers inside the car. You know, there's got to be something like that. That's got to be just basic wiring, I'd imagine, wouldn't it? Depending on the type of speaker that you're looking to use.
You'd think so. I may have to be the guy to invent it. We'll see. Maybe nobody's thought of it before. Like I mentioned, I also do my Halloween playlist, like Dead Man's Party and the original Ghostbusters theme, and a whole bunch of copyrighted stuff that would get me in trouble. So could all hook that up to the same system.
Monster Mash.
That's been a good one too. I'm sure I could look somewhere for Halloween playlist and get the whole thing.
What are those like big like horn shaped speakers that you see like outside of like schools from like the 1950s and whatnot?
Yeah, I would think a public address system, wiring a public address system speaker under the hood.
Well, even on top, depending on the size of the speaker, and then just run a line. If you could just open up the stereo, get behind there should be a line to one of the speakers. You have to cut it, splice it, split it somehow, and then run one line up there, or send it up to the line up to like a switch box, so that you can just kind of flip that on, so whatever you have playing on your stereo can just go to that other speaker as well.
And we've just been joined by Jay Lindsay, who I invited earlier this afternoon.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Good, how are
Pretty
you?
Pretty good. Okay, let's jump to the topic I wanted to discuss with Jay Lindsay. And if he's free to hang on for the rest of the show, that's fine. We're kind of jumping over listener feedback. Kay Wisher, we saw that, and we will be talking about it. But if you didn't know, as listeners, if you don't join us in the Freenode channel, #Ogcast Planet, earlier this week we'd been having some trouble with spam. And I've seen him today in some other channels. Kay Wisher mentioned that he was, or whoever it was, I shouldn't say he, she, it, whatever, we don't know, them, have been, even though they've gotten blocked, of, at least for now, out of Ogcast, they've been taking advantage of some other channels, and, you know, just seemingly for random lines constantly repeated with some rather unsavory links. You know, probably not the worst. I didn't click on all of them. I clicked on one and that was enough. But, you know, clickbait sort of stuff. And just over and over again, about every 5 minutes, where it just got incredibly annoying. And the change Jay Lindsay made as op was so that you could not comment in Oddcast Planet unless your nick was registered with Freenode, which not everybody does. The main reason to do it is usually protect yourself so somebody else can't just take over your nick and pose as you. But other than that, a lot of people don't bother with it. So that was, you know, I think Jay Lindsay said in the channel, well, it's going to make work for some people, but, you know, probably the easiest way to, get rid of the spammer. And, I already put a link in the show notes. I think I know how Jay Lindsay did it. So, but I'll let him talk about what, you know, what all went on and how it was corrected.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's not the ideal solution because you do you lose that ability for people to just jump in whenever without registering. But I guess this is going to be a necessary step. It's pretty much the recommended way to go. There's no real server-side way to handle that situation yet. I think Freenode is actually working on a deeper solution for that. But essentially, all you're doing is setting a flag on the channel, which is the plus R flag. And you just do that with the slash mode and then the channel name and then plus R, which essentially locks out anyone who isn't registered and identified. That's an important distinction because some people seem to be confused about that. Not only do you need to be registered, but you have to actually identify to NickServe to tell it you're you can do it several ways. You can have your client automatically identify, which basically it just sends a string slash message NickServe identify and then your password. If you use the encryption, the SASL encryption, then it basically automatically identifies, so you can do that too. But once you identify, then that's what's letting you into the channel. The other thing I did was put the plus F flag on the channel, which allows you to forward anyone who is dropped by that plus R flag to another channel. And I put some instructions in the topic in there to be able to register and identify. It's basically just to catch people so that they're not automatically blocked, and it catches those people and gives them the information they need to get into the proper channel.
Oh yeah, thanks for reminding me of the plus F. I'd already identified what you did with the plus R, but because yeah, we it's possible #NextLogCast could become a target. And I'd said earlier, if you know, if that starts happening, since I've got op on that channel, I could do it, or Honky could, or Kay Wisher, whenever we start to see stuff like that happening, or Father Finch, you know, go ahead and do the mode plus R and take care of it. But thanks for reminding me of the plus F, so we don't bounce people who are just innocently coming in. At least
yeah,
without giving him an explanation.
It's kind of a tricky situation because these bots are actually just looking for channels that are populated. There's no rhyme or reason to why they're doing, you know, specific channels. It's just, you know, they look for a certain number of users that they can hit, and then they just join the channel and start spamming.
Well, part of the problem is, of course, the nick changed every time, and also, at least from what Freenode was reporting, the apparent IP. So it looked like they're sort of spoofing IP. So you can't just get out the ban hammer and ban that user.
Yeah, it's also the reason that they ended up with services like Mibit, which are designed to take the client out of the equation and just have a website that people can go to get on networks, IRC networks. They had to actually ban that service because of this spam issue.
Now, is there, I guess Last Known God was looking, researching about what he, you know, if he could write a bot or whatever, but apparently any bot that could block someone would need elevated permissions, which is, he said, is not recommended. And the way this was working doesn't look, if you were blocking them retroactively, I don't think it would do any good. I don't know if a bot could, you know, look at everything coming in and decide who can and who can't talk.
Yeah, that's definitely a complicated issue. You're going to have to catch that first line of text and then set the ban or a quiet or whatever to shut that bot up.
Now, if I recall, when I first registered my nick, I had to associate that with a email address and then got the email and had to respond to the email, didn't I?
Yeah, that's what makes it so annoying for them to be able to register and then spam, because you're going to have to get in the email and actually reply to that. It's one more step in the chain that I think a lot of people who are running these botnets, they don't go that far, really.
Right. I imagine you could get an account on one of these temporary email servers, and not that I want to give these guys any idea, but there probably could be a way that you could automate that. But like you said, that gives a higher level of complexity, and hopefully they'll go at a lower hanging fruit.
Yeah, and there's still a whole bunch of channels on Freenode that are just not gonna be set to registered users, and unfortunately, it looks like more and more are gonna have to go that way to stop it.
Well, I don't want to advertise these guys, so I'm not gonna mention the users I'm looking at. But at least one of them is like the, you know, is the official help channel for a product, and yeah, I can see why they might rather let the spam go than go to the part about forcing registered users, because that's probably a whole nother level of complexity that the casual user just wanting to get a question answered isn't going to want to do.
Yeah, it's hard to put up that barrier when you're trying to provide some simple support. You're gonna push some legitimate users away.
And Vulcan Rider in Oddcast Planet, he gave me a link to various places where are links to bots, anti-spam bots that people have written. So if we get to that point, we need another level. You know, I've got that saved, and we can. See if any of those are appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that there are some good bots out there for taking care of that. They just have to pick up on some common themes that are in these spam messages, and then, like you said, though, they have to have a higher level of access to take care of that. And it's you don't necessarily have to give the bot everything under the sun. I mean, there's granular levels of security that Freenode can provide.
And on that topic, you know, I noticed that Ogbot and Botly are both offline in Oddcast Planet and in Hash Linux Lugcast right now. If anybody's wondering, this all has to do with each other, but I guess those are being revamped or whatever. I know for them to get back into Oddcast Planet, they're going to need permission from an op to do so, I guess.
Yeah, those typically bots have a way to automatically identify their nicks. And I would think the software behind Botly would have it. So it's just a matter of getting that bot to identify before it joins.
Yeah, I remember when I was running a bot, I had an identifying with my regular nick.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything inherently blocking that thing. It's just a matter of getting it to identify, and it should be fine after that.
Okay, just a coincidence. I mean, it's the same two bots, in both channels. So that's the owners of those bots are probably working on them or seeing what they need to do, and that's why they're not currently running. So we usually talk at the end of the show about the .ns script to identify when the next showtime is. That's why that's not running in Linux Slugcast right now. Well, it's unfortunate. Some people seem to be jerks, and I have no idea what they could possibly gain from it. Who's going to click on those links? I guess somebody must, or they wouldn't do it, but must be money in it somewhere. You know, one idiot out of 10,000 or 1,000 or what follows those links. Well, I guess I should say, I thought there was some talk about it down below, and I didn't look to see who the Nick posted a link, so I clicked one of them, and so I'm guessing I'm that idiot. But I certainly didn't follow. I saw it, didn't look really legit, so I certainly didn't follow any of the links on the page that was open. So, sorry, I was eating during the show. Eating during the show caused me to start coughing. Well, Jay Lindsay, have anything to add on this?
No, not in particular. I guess we're gonna have to keep it registered. Registered only. Don't really see any way around it unless we get some kind of a advanced bot in there. And there's other protections you can put on your personal NIC that'll protect you from private messages and things like that. But I think the Freenode spam problem is here to stay, unfortunately. So you're gonna have to keep those barriers up.
Well, thank you for writing in, saving the day, and solving the problem on Oddcast Planet, as you do so often. And in general, folks out there, Jay Lindsay's the guy who knows more about this stuff than, or has forgotten more about a lot of this stuff than a lot of us will ever learn. And we get stuck problem a lot of times. Can't figure it out. We holler at Jay Lindsay and IRC. And usually he comes in and saves our bacon. So I want to thank you. Thanks for doing that one more time for us. And hope you have time to stay for the rest of the show. But if not, understand that too.
Yeah, it's actually unfortunate. It caught me a little off guard because I've been gone for a little while. And I came back and the channel was a mess. So I apologize for that.
No, you got a life outside of this whole internet and IRC and all of that. I figured somebody'd show up and knew how to do it, and then once you did it, I looked what you did and found documentation on it. So that if Linux Slugcast becomes a target, then I'll know how to fix it.
Yeah, there's only been a couple of cases I saw in Linux Slugcast where somebody was basically just grabbing everyone's NIC and throwing it in the channel to get their attention. But nothing to the extreme that I saw in Oddcast Planet yet.
Yeah, I have seen that, and I may, you can probably ban that person, but it's probably the same thing. They're gonna keep. Changing their NIC and their apparent IP every time.
Yeah, that's just a bot iterating over IP addresses and NICs. It can do that infinitely if it wants to.
Okay, we did have some feedback on G+ from Kay Wisher, and apparently he had problems with the controller on a 3D printer that he acquired. Sounds like maybe he got it when it was already broken, and looks like there's a way you can replace the controller on a 3D printer with a Raspberry Pi. Interesting thing, Raspberry Pi is not a real-time system. So, like the microcontroller is, but if I read it correctly, how they're getting around it is they are just every time the yeah, it's tying it into a memory address that is updated. Sorry, still got something stuck in my throat. With the timing controller on every clock tick, so it doesn't really require an interface by the CPU, which I found was interesting. I'm not sure, you know, it's a very, very long and involved article, which I don't think it would take me the rest of the show to read that and understand and try to explain to you what's going on. So if you're interested in that, take a look in the show notes. But sounds like, you know, you could run all your software on the Pi you're using as a controller, but essentially saying it's putting the instructions directly out on the GPIO pins at every clock tick. Earlier in the article, it says you'd have to have an Arduino, and then later it seems to be like they're not. So I'd have to reread it to see exactly what they're doing. But very interesting. But it looks like you'd be able to install your slicer software and all that directly on the printer with this setup. Honky, you're the one posting the show notes. Is that a fair assessment, or did I get it all wrong?
That's more what I can see. You're right. There's a very, very in-depth notes on how to do this. So
I'll make sure that they see this over at the makers. And, you know, if they were, I haven't heard them talk about anything like this, so I think they'd be very, very interested in it.
But one thing, though, is it seems like all you have to do is install Pi CNC on the Raspberry Pi, and then use that as, what is it? Yeah, the single board computer. It says such as Raspberry Pi, Odroids, BeagleBones, and others, and then just hook that up into the system. The rest of the article seems to be explaining how Pi CNC works. CNCing is about is the same idea as the 3D printing, so I'm guessing it's that there's has to be some sort of conversion, though, because since I'm not big on this, but I'm guessing CNCing is kind of like the reverse of 3D printing. You're not creating something in the middle, but you're cutting something out of the wood. But I'm sure the code to move the thing around is pretty much the same. It's just getting it to do the opposite. And once it knows that, I think it's just the same thing. Basically, it's just put Pi CNC, put the distribution Pi CNC onto the Raspberry Pi, and then hook that up.
Yeah, it kind of makes me wonder, no more than a Pi cost, why 3D printers aren't built like this in the first place. And Kay Wisher, when you hear this, you know, you get this working, please come join us on the show and tell us how it all went and what you can do with it and all that.
Or even just email us and write something out and email us. That'd be good.
Yeah, either way, great link.
Yeah.
Well, I think I'll let you go first, Talking Bigoo, because I didn't really do anything this week but collect links.
Well, so the one thing I actually accomplished this week was after bashing my head against the wall for past several weeks. Granted, it wasn't, you know, these are just like maybe half hour, hour increments of trying to get something done. So let me just explain. I've been trying to so the touchpad on one of my laptops, the left mouse click doesn't work. And so I've just been having to use the touchpad to get the left mouse click, which works fine up until the point you want to actually drag and drop stuff or highlight stuff or whatever. So I ran into a few situations where I had to do that, in which case I usually wound up attaching wireless keyboards that also have touchpads on it and stuff. So I usually wound up just using that, but I figure this is Linux. I should be able to remap that left touchpad to that left mouse click to something on my keyboard. And there were several things that said that it could do it. So I was playing around with two other applications for a while. One was XDoTool, and the other one was called AutoKey. I believe it was called AutoKey. Yes, AutoKey. And XDoTool is a very complex tool that basically you tell XDoTool to do like a list of commands that include moving the mouse cursor and hitting the left mouse click, and it'll do it. But it doesn't necessarily work if you want to. Well, it probably could. I just couldn't find an easy way to do it. Remap. Like, let's say the Windows key or the super key to be also work as the left mouse click. And same thing with AutoKey. With AutoKey, I actually got it to work as a left mouse click, but I couldn't get it to work as being able to, you know, highlight or drag or, you know, do that. So after a lot of Googling with trying to find out how to do it and try to figure out how to use these two tools, I found this link that I put into the show notes where somebody asked, apparently a long time ago, since he was running Ubuntu 10.10, on how to do this exact thing. And apparently all I needed to do was install a tool called XMOD map, and quite literally I installed that. I used a program that's I believe just installed on most systems automatically called, but it's just XEV, and that just shows like all the information as to where on the screen the pointer is and what the key code is for each button that you push. So you get XMOD map installed, and you run XEV, and with that you figure out which is button. Like I wanted to use the super button or the Windows button as like my left mouse button, and so you basically just push it and see what it brings up in the terminal. And the key code for that for me was 133. And then you type in XKB set space M, and then type in XMOD map. So it's XMOD MAP space dash E. Quotations key code 133 space equals pointer underscore button, and then it would be button one. So the buttons were one for left, two for middle, and then three for your right. So mine would be button one, and it's all listed out in the link I put in the show notes. And it just worked. It's fantastic. Now I just need to put this probably into a little, because every time I shut down and restart back up, I have to do the XKB set M and then the XMOD map, run those commands. So I think I have to put that into a script and then somehow set that up so it'll run on startup. But right now, I mean, it works beautifully. I mean, I used it a few minutes ago to highlight Kay Wisher's thing that he put on G+, just saying, getting ready to pull the trigger on the required parts to replace the failed controller printer. I was able to use it to highlight that and just do a quick copy and paste. and it worked fantastically. So after playing around with other tools that got me close to but didn't do the job, I found this, and it works beautifully.
Well, also document when you get it to run on startup automatically, because that's changed in the last few years, and not everybody's learned how to do it. That'd be a good example to help teach people. Yeah, you want to run something on startup. This is the way you do it now.
Yeah, I learned a little bit about cron jobs back when I set up my Raspberry Pi weather clock. When I set that up, I learned a little bit about cron jobs, but from my understanding with systemd, I believe you can still get cron jobs and install the application to run do cron jobs, but now everything is basically set up as I forget what that thing's called, but it's all basically run in systemd as programs in systemd that you set up to automatically start and whatnot. I'm brain fart is what they call it.
I think it's systemd and init. I was just doing my Google foo because I was trying to remember what does it replace system 5, and of course we've been with systemd the last 5 years. I should know all this by now, or not have to look for it.
Yes. So yeah, it's a service. You basically set it up as a systemd service that you can start and stop. But I got to do that also with my Raspberry Pi that I have set up as my media server and all that, because every time the power freaking goes out, I got to go back, I got to log on to it and have it restart Samba and Mediatomb. So that's one thing I really have to sit down and look at. So.
Okay. I guess if I go next,
just real quick, I put in, real quick, it's not anything too crazy. It's a article on Hackaday that talks about there is somebody working on getting FOSS software on e-readers. Basically, it's a guy hacking e-readers. It's more of an article than anything. I just thought it was interesting, and I threw it into the show notes for reading. If somebody wants to take a look at this, a guy kind of explains how he's going through and putting open source software onto e-readers. Doesn't give any details on how to do it, unfortunately. I think the most details that he gave was that on some of the older Kindles, he used, where was it? I can't find it. He was able to it was a serial port on the older Kindles. So he was able to hack into them with through the serial port.
Nice. I'll be interested in looking at that article. Welcome Swift 110. This is the part where you're supposed to talk, Swifty. Or maybe he just wants to listen, we'll see. Or maybe he's having trouble on his end. So, he's in Passion Linux Slugcast, so can you... Oh, yeah, he's eating. Okay. So we'll talk to him in a minute. One discussion I wanted to start, I thought was kind of important this evening. Now, I don't have a link for this because I didn't see it online. I saw it more in it was an online news report, but it was a video report. That, like, the European Parliament and all that was moving towards fining social media sites for posting fake news. And that would, in other words, that would make Facebook responsible for whatever stupid link that 5150 posts, and whether it was accurate or not. Now, don't get me wrong, I would like to have them have a bot running in there, and every time there was a link posted, you know, and stuff said, you know, that had already been a subject of something like Snopes or whatever, saying, no, this is completely made up, or it's partially true, you know, maybe just redirect you to the Snopes article automatically. That's something they could probably do. But, I mean, if they're going to do this, they're probably going to have to make it for every site. So that means anybody that has a forum are going to have to probably manually research every link that gets posted. In other words, you're once again, it's going to break the internet by making the manager of every website responsible for every link that gets posted and verifying it before it goes out. In other words, you'd have to have it so links aren't automatic or posts aren't automatically updated. Somebody has to go through and look at them, and of course that's going to be for most of us, that's going to be completely prohibitive and totally break the internet. So I would like a way to get rid of these patent fake news things, because I'll see it. My friends will post something and it'll be something, you know, I would wish to be true maybe sometime. It's you know, it seems to be stuff on my side, stuff that I would wish to be true is sort of stuff that, you know, that I'd wish not to be true. And I can come back and defend it and say, no, that's completely false and made up. No, it's usually stuff that looks bad for the other side. It's, yeah, I wish that was true, but I look it up and completely falsified or exaggerated or misidentified or whatever, you know. And I'd like it so I wouldn't have to be the guy to, you know, make the post. No, I looked this up on Snopes or whatever, and it's not right. I wish that was automatic, but that's fine if they could do that just for Facebook and Gplus or whatever. But, you know, they make it on every website. It's going to be cost prohibitive to have the website and let people post.
What is Snopes?
Snopes.com, that's usually the thing that people go to see, you know, you type in that, you know, that somebody makes a post that Donald Trump is a 5,000-year-old space alien, you know, you go to Snopes, Donald Trump is a 5,000-year-old space alien, and it says, no, this is probably not true. So that's what people, that's usually what people set up there as the standard for verifying things. But the thing is, you've seen stuff, oh, no, they're paid shills for this side, or it's a man and a wife who do this. But I've seen people say, oh, you can't go by that site because they're paid shills for both sides. But usually if you put a link like, or a topic into Google, you'll get somebody saying that no, this is not accurate information. If it is indeed not accurate,
never seen that before. Thank you.
And now I guess we can say welcome, Swift 110.
Thank you. It's good to hear from you guys. Did you just hear me?
You're getting like some serious reverb there, man. But thanks for coming on.
I'll turn the volume down.
Do you have maybe both your mic and your headphones open at the same time, or are you using just like a speakers and a mic?
Just speakers on the laptop.
Okay, that probably explains. Well, I know you were looking for mainly a way to listen to the show, but probably in the future, a headset's the best way to go, if possible. I mean, I don't want to discourage anybody from joining in. It's just that you know, and I don't want to be like somebody, oh no, if you can't live up to this sound quality, you're not invited. Like some people who might remain nameless, but I'm just saying, you know, you're when you talk, the sound quality is not the best.
Okay, thanks.
Anybody else have an opinion on this whole finding people for quote fake news? And the other part is who decides, you know, depending on what government is in power, what is and is not fake news?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the road they're going down there. Craigslist had a similar problem where they had to remove the personal ads because they could be held criminally liable for anything posted to that website.
Right. And I've, you know, we've all seen forums where somebody posts, you know, links to unsavory and perhaps even illegal sites. But how do you do a customer forum, you know, if you have to verify every post?
Yeah, you're starting to walk the line between, you know, free speech and, you know, fake news is obviously a dangerous thing. I mean, we've seen Cold War kind of tactics from Russia even recently on Facebook and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, and usually I would paint the social media host as the bad guy on this, and I think, like I said, I think they could have done more, but actually finding him in court, you know, or finding him, I would think, and especially if you went to some, you know, if they started to hit somebody small, and tried to hold them to the same standard, somebody did not have the resources to check every post and check every link posted and verify it again, you know. And like I said, what if you say, okay, that looks fine to me, and you let it go through, and whatever regulatory agency is going to be assigned to this disagrees. So I'm hoping this would just patently get thrown out on First Amendment grounds. But, you know, that usually takes years and dollars in court to get it done. And probably Google and Facebook have the resources and whatever just to roll over rather than, you know, and then how does that leave everybody else?
Well, Google has already done that on their images.
Actually, they rolled that back. It was that way for about a week. They said, nope, we won't show any copyrighted images. And then, you know, they went back to, hey, be aware that some of these images may be copyrighted, because it was getting where they couldn't put anything up.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, even your, but you no longer have the view link, if I recall correctly.
No, they put it back.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see some kind of statistics on the age groups. Like, you would think young people are less susceptible to, you know, what's on the internet is true. I mean, pretty much no one I could think of would believe that. So it's you kind of want to say it comes down to finding the reliable news sources and sticking with them. But at the same time, obviously the fake news thing works. Obviously it does. I mean, there's proof, but people just believe anything.
Well, I found a link here 6 months ago to, okay, these are all the ads that supposedly the Russians posted on Facebook, and I didn't see any of them. I think it was location-based. They probably, if they were trying to push one party over the other, then probably in my area, you know, Well, it's like political ads. You never see political presidential ads till a week before the election where I am, because the area is already spoken for. There's not, you know who's going to win. There's not much point. Whereas the rest of the country gets deluged for 8 months with with political acts to the point they're sick of it. Now, when I did look at these things that supposedly had gone out on Facebook, you know, they did fit with my pre-existing political mindset, so I really wasn't, you know, I wasn't offended by them. But on the other hand, you know, if I'd seen one from the other party, you know, that was, you know, just as far out there making claims and whatever, you know, I'm certainly not going to be persuaded by seeing something on Facebook and saying, oh, no, you know, I've picked the wrong side. I've got to switch parties.
Yeah, I think, you know, things are just going to get weirder and weirder as we're moving toward, you know, developing AI and basically the news can generate itself and it can twist the news in whatever way, you know, the people behind the scenes want it to be twisted.
What was it? One article we'll get to, my last link, if we get to it, and it could wait, but Gizmodo article. I kind of pulled in some old links I'd skipped over, but saying it, you know, and this is not directly open source, but deep fake videos are getting where even the experts can't tell what's real video and what is generated. And I don't know. It seems like one of the candidates once said that they could shoot somebody in the middle of Times Square. I don't know if that was Trump or not, or if that was some time back in history or some sort of claim, and have video of it and still get elected. But I seem to remember some quote like that. Well, you could actually do that. You know, you could, you know, we are certainly getting to the point. I mean, one of the things I plan to do next couple weeks is go see Christopher Robin, because it's, you know, I'm interested in the story. Of course, it's a G-rated, you know, movie that may not go for everybody, but definitely you see the previews, and, you know, that video is getting just about good enough that you think that they've got a stuffed animal walking around and talking there on the screen, and get, you know, give it 15, 20 years. I don't know if we'll even need actors anymore. I'm going to say, you tie that into the fake news. Oh, wow. Maybe it's game over. I don't know.
Yeah, we've been seeing for years, we've been seeing, you know, these tech articles that are, they're very in-depth and they're thorough. And they're ads. You just don't realize it until you take a deep dive into that article and how it's written that you're reading an advertisement.
Yeah, in a lot of places, at least in magazines, they always have to say at the top, it's an ad, you know, maybe not on a website, but you're right. I've seen those and started reading and thought, you know, oh, this is an interesting article.
Yeah, it works out the same way with, you know, the news. Like, they're saying these are facts, but there's a certain twist on that you're not going to find until you dig deeper.
And even the actual legitimate news has been fooled by these fake news sites. You know, you've had the real news, have links in there from a joke or a satire site, I should say, and not realize it. I mean, I would think most of these places would know what the Onion was, but there's a few other there. Others that are a little more subtle. So you've had the some of those articles requoted as fake news. Sometimes you've had, you know, stuff requoted on TV and turns out, oh, yeah, we found out that this was a complete hoax.
Yeah, there's already several cases that you can find that, you know, communities like Reddit and things like that are, like, they'll point something out. And they're all going to go for it. Like, they're all behind this one idea. And then an actual legitimate news source will pick it up and run it without fact-checking anything. There's just enough people behind it that it just gets broadcast as news.
Okay, that's exactly what I was thinking of, is news sources picking up something off of Reddit. Okay, let's hope. I mean, apparently a month ago we had a similar internet breaking threat with the EU was going to force any publication to charge if a link to their website showed up on any other site. We talked about that, I think, the last show, and that would completely destroy the internet because I wouldn't be able to post the links to support things that that we talk about if that were in place. And apparently 2/3 of the European Union's parliament thought, no, that's not a very good idea. I think there's a lot of campaigning to educate people in the last few weeks. However, that means 1/3 of them did think that was a pretty good idea, which is scary. So again, this type of idea, finding websites for fake news, is going to be going through the European Union and Parliament, and perhaps our own Congress, both which are dominated by old people who don't understand technology, and it's just gonna scare everybody.
Well, look what Massachusetts has done. With firearms, these guns look military, so therefore their primary use must be military, and they're now illegal. I mean, anyone who can conjure that can conjure any kind of shoot the messenger bill. Fake news? Yeah, well, how many have you verified all the inputs to your website?
Well, exactly, and though I think it's probably the more conservative people who are more likely to go for something like this rather than the liberal types, but there's probably a significant amount of people on both sides of the aisle who have absolutely no idea how tech works, and never been a member of a group who had a small website like we would, and have forums or I mean, even if something went through or it came in through email and we posted it, you know, and got up in the show notes, and you know, probably less likely than, you know, and especially since we wouldn't necessarily do a whole lot of political stuff, though I guess this discussion could be considered political. But
well, look at the entire YouTube universe.
Well, that's true. YouTube had to start checking the veracity of everything that came up, you know. What if somebody on one of my favorite channels is Today I Found Out, what if somebody went in and said, oh, no, that guy's wrong. Sue YouTube for fake news because of the origin of the frying pan 350 years ago. Well, they're probably older than that. I don't know. You know, but that's the type of thing that guy does. And some of the things, well, you know, a lot of times things is, okay, sometimes, you know, we don't know exactly where this came from. This is, you know, the most common theory, but there's other people, you know, we think it came from here. But not necessarily. So somebody get on YouTube and say, oh, that's obviously fake news. We need to sue you or fine you or whatever. Probably wouldn't get that far. But yeah, I think there's people out there don't realize what a rat hole this would be to get into.
Yeah, it would be a black hole because you know, wait a minute, you said that was this done at this time. Well, actually, it was done at that time. You're off by 15 minutes. You must be faking the news.
In any case, I think I want to go on to my next link if everybody thinks we're done with this one.
Yes, please move on to the next link while we still have links.
Yes, I want to thank Alcon DK if he's listening. He's been posting. I didn't even know this was a thing. Odroid is making a Game Boy Go clone. I guess it's actually an Arduino board, from what I'm guessing. But it's a handheld, and it's cheaper than the little video game thing I assembled last fall. It's the Odroid Go, $32, and yes, you can. If you have the ROMs for Game Boy Go games, of course, so all remember it's illegal to have the ROM if you don't legitimately have the game. But it, you know, it will run all those. And even though I never bought Game Boy Go back in the day because it wasn't something really especially a small console didn't really interest me. A small computing device does. You can add on, I guess there's a bunch of stuff, also equipment you can add on, like I guess environmental sensors and various other type of sensors, you know, and like I put in the show notes, yeah, $32, shut up and take my money. Says on their website, and probably cheaper on Ameridroid if they have them. But that link there on Odroid.com, it's or HardKernel.com rather, who make the Odroid, $32. And Honky, you're missing talking into a mic a couple times this evening. Just wanted to let you know.
Sorry, move the mic to eat some goldfish. So basically, you purchase a kit and you assemble it yourself.
Yeah, it's very much like the kit that you guys go back and find. Listeners, go back and find the link. The kit that I got from the little tiny arcade machine that's Arduino based last fall that I talked about building. But this is handheld and about the same form factor as a. Old Game Boy Go. It's got a clear case, so you can see the inside components. So it's very similar, and yet even cheaper, a lot bigger screen. So, you know, if I were to be made to choose between the two of them, plus you could apparently add on a whole bunch of these other non-gaming accessories. And instead of like this one I have, the tiny arcade playing a whole bunch of made up clone games. Like I said, you could install apparently install Game Boy ROMs on it.
Yeah, for $32, I agree. Shut up and take my money.
Yeah, if this was like $100 or something, you know, no, probably not. But shoot, yeah, I'll let you guys know how it goes. I'll see if I can get and no soldering on. Well, there wasn't any soldering on the other one either. But you know, no soldering, anything like that I can test. So it all just plugs in. And next one, and I haven't really done a lot of looking at this, it was a link I got from, well, the latest few random show notes. Got a chance to listen to the show yet, sorry guys. But I thought this was something we'd be interested in. NitroPi Mumble Soundboard. So it's a simple node soundboard for Mumble. Now, from the name, I'm guessing you got to install this on a Pi. You know, it's not like software you install on your system alongside Mumble. This is a distro you install on a Pi. But like I said, I haven't looked into that deep yet. So definitely is something. You know, I don't think you guys want me in control of the soundboard for the show if we were to have one. But I've always found soundboards interesting. So. This is definitely something I want to take a look at.
I thought you got it as a Docker container.
Well, it does talk about Docker on there, so maybe you're right. I don't know where the Pi comes in then. Maybe it's just a coincidence. Yeah, I had all these open.
Sorry. I think it'd be a cool idea to have a soundboard, but I don't know, or even a bot. But I'm not sure what we'd use it for.
Yeah, you know, Tilts likes to... recycle embarrassing things that people have said, but I'm not sure we're that type of show. But it might be, you know, if we wanted to actually insert bumper music during the show or something, you know, something like that. Like I said, it's something I want to look at, but not necessarily I want to implement for this show.
Are you trying to class the place up a little bit?
Oh, perish the thought.
And if you haven't checked out the U-Random podcast, you really, really should.
Yes, it's urandom.podcast.info. And we're expecting our check, guys. Okay, that gets me back to my links. I'd scrolled the other way before the show and hadn't realized it. Yeah, it's a simple soundboard bot and web client for Mumble. So I guess maybe it doesn't take a second computer. Bot will idle on a specific channel on your Mumble server, which takes slash commands, and a web UI will be served up also to control the soundboard. If you run it outside of Docker, you will need Node and NPM. So this might be something to be cool to learn a little Docker on, because I'm still kind of fuzzy on the whole container thing.
Our show notes are on Docker running on a banana pi.
Nice. Yeah, I remember you saying how you installed that. So like I said, I did not have time to do my do prep on this, so it's don't have it currently running, but maybe by next time I'll get it installed and have it there at least so I can talk about the process. Interesting, I thought a lot of these, I was kind of scrambling for content, so I did some of these are links that I'd skipped over before, this IT Pro link that I put on pretty much follows, it's an interview with Eric Raymond, but it pretty much follows the one of his talks itself, and talked about how he can, in fact, I was just reading today in the Cathedral and the Bazaar. I'm just sort of starting it. But a quote from someone, he said that, your software is not done when there's nothing left to add. It's done when there's nothing left to subtract, which, fairly serendipitously goes in with this article. But, he manages, one of the things he manages is NTP, the Network Time Protocol, which is all how, all our network-connected computers and devices all now have the accurate time on them without having run an internal clock and a battery like we did back in the Stone Ages, is because we're pulling it from the next higher computer in the network. So everything on your network is pulling the time off the router, and your router's pulling the time off the ISP, and the ISP's pulling the time off, whoever they're connected to. And that's all in NTP, the Network Time Protocol, that Eric Raymond, I think, wrote originally, or if he didn't, he's in charge of it now. But what he was talking about itself is they were going back in because they were looking at the protocols used to connect to NTP and stuff that they had drivers for, and saying, well, this hasn't been a thing in 20 years, so we can safely take it out and make the code smaller and make less chance of something, if they're being up. Because of this ancient code, no one relies on anymore. But he did talk about, they were taking stuff up, and some organization suddenly sent him an email and said, hey, you just broke our time server. I think it was a university or something. They were not the oldest protocol, old enough that they thought safely that they could pull it out. Nobody used it anymore. And, Eric Raymond says, well, okay, I would rather do it that way, have somebody complain, and then put it back in the next revision, than not go through and try to clean up the code. So like I said, the article pretty much shadows, and apparently they talked to him at self, it pretty much shadows what that one talk he did at Cell is that I happened to be there for, so... if you want to see something that happened itself, you know, look there.
GCC link shows that Raymond doesn't follow his own principles when it comes to software.
Okay, why don't we wait till we get down to that one, let's talk about that, because sometimes, you know, people are hypocritical in what they, well, I don't know, hypocritical is the right word, but inconsistent in what they say and what they do. So, or no, let's go ahead, let's tie it in. Netminder did have a link they wanted to put in on. They were moving the GCC repository, not repository, but the code base from SVN to Git, and having it just, they thought it would work, and they tried to run it, and it didn't. It did not go. You know, when they checked the database from the one to the other after they just rolled it all over, it was, you know, it wasn't the same. And I guess one of the early problems. Now I don't know if this, surely this is not that GCC that the code base is running on a computer physically in Eric Raymond's house. I don't know, but they said they had to add 4 meg. Well, that maybe means they added 4 meg to whatever online virtual machine that it's running on, so they could make this conversion. But apparently, when they did, it still, when they checked the code base, they didn't match between SVN and Git. And essentially, Eric in the article says, "Look, the code's too big. The tools won't handle it. I'm not going to try this again." And I guess that's what you were talking about. You know, continuing to run SVN is not practicing what he preaches, Netminder.
No, it's the conversion tool that is about 14,000 lines of Python. That when people who know Python examined it, well, they weren't too kind. It's the comments on that article that is where the meat is.
Oh, that explains why I didn't see that. I did not scroll down and read the comments.
Oh, and the machine he's working on is a physical machine with 64 gigabytes of memory.
So this is actually in his possession sitting somewhere.
In his possession. There's even a YouTube video about building the monster for this purpose. The problem is that there are so many squirrely... Well, part of the problem is that there are so many squirrely bits in the GCC SVN, you know, branches and branches of branches and branches of branches of branches, that they crash on corner cases. And the second thing is, while he has a multi-core machine, his conversion tool appears to be single-threaded.
Right. I remember him complaining, well, we can't get any one core over 1.3 gigahertz, and it's not fast enough.
Well, also, Python is a great language. It has many features. Also, he's using something called PyPy, which I don't know if it's a Python-to-Python compiler or something. But people say that that's not necessarily the fastest way to do Python either.
Well, PyPy is that thing that they use to, you know, for like rapid game development to teach kids how to program. That's another thing I saw in the article, is that Eric says, well, he's not the most talented Python programmer as of yet. He's trying to learn.
Yeah, well, it's... Also, it's a monolithic program, supposedly, with a lot of reinvention of wheels, like its own date class and stuff like that, which other Python libraries provide.
And I guess one of the things he wants to do is convert his Python to Go, or maybe it was, he knows Python but not Go, because I would think surely he would know his way around something like Python, but I don't know why that would be better, but that was one of the things that maybe he convert, if everybody waits for him to be able to convert from Python to Go, I guess is what he wants. And Go is sort of a similar interpreted language. Somebody's going to yell at me for saying similar. It's an interpreted language that was developed by Google. Not used as many people as Python. Some people, I think it's the new hotness, but I'm not sure why converting from one to the other would be of an advantage. There's people who are more into writing code than I am, especially with the newer languages, that could probably explain that.
Well, the people that looked at his Python and threw up are, you know, this is, he basically wrote this huge monolith. That's why I compared it to OS 360. And anyone who tries to chew on it says it's got to be refactored, it's got to be broken down, it's got to be whatever. Now, maybe after writing this huge chunk of Python, he believes that Go semantics is more compatible with the job or something, but I don't know Go, so I can't tell. Also, Go doesn't have, at the moment, Python has tremendous library support, which it seems that he ignored, but he may be looking at it as a more manageable proposition because the language is already more basic.
Okay, I would think as many Python experts as we have out there that, you know, I mean, it's open source, the code's out there. This is probably what Eric or Mr. Raymond would say. Shouldn't call him Eric, even though I've met him a couple of times. He might say, well, the code's there. If somebody thinks that they can rewrite the code to make it more efficient, have at it, you know, especially as a group effort. Many eyes looking at it, you know, would be a dawning prospect for one coder. You know, for 100, they might get, you know, or 50 or 20 or 10, you know, they might whip it out pretty fast.
The problem is, it appears to be a mud pie. There's no modularization, there's incredible nested if-thens, there's a whole bunch of stuff. So the people who know Python don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole before it's refactored, and the people who know how to refactor it aren't going to touch it either.
Well, this is why open source is always an adventure.
Also, there are other tools. KDE did a similar transition with interim crunching to break things down into edible chunks. I mean, break their SVM base to edible chunks. So there are tools from the KDE transition. And there's a KDE knowledge base of how to do a transition. And evidently, Eric just did a single charge ahead. And while he's many things, he's no Linux Torvalds, who basically spit get out from scratch.
Well, even his book, I think he admits that he's not Linux. There's, you know, so there, those guys, you know, it's one of the things he says. Those guys are a level above me. If I'm quoting him right, he'd probably jump on the show and tell me all the wrong things I've said about his book, which I would invite him to do at any time.
Well, I'm just saying what I saw from the comments. I don't know Python that well. I've got plenty of Python books and whatnot, but I haven't decided to jump into it just yet, but for a couple of things. But it appears that while he's got something that would work on smaller cases, his machine, even with the huge memory, just didn't do it. But then again, one of the criticisms they have that he doesn't have any kind of sane memory management or what have you.
And I just came up. That's a brilliant idea, 50, is if I just get on here and say all kinds of stupid things about famous people like Linus and Eric Raymond that we would like to have on this show. You know, say a whole bunch of wrong stuff and have it be fake news and invite them to come on and correct me. Then we could actually get these guys on the show. Brilliant.
Well, except some of them are so used to people misquoting them. Probably Linux. And do you really want Stallman here?
I think we're safe unless we change the name of the show to the Good New Linux Slugcast, which I'm not saying we shouldn't have done that in the first place, but it's a little bit late now.
Yeah, well, I remember buying his, and I think I bought it a couple of times, his GNU tools for Windows and DOS. Never have I seen anyone sell something against what they're selling.
See, it sounds like you're all full of topics you haven't brought to us yet.
Well, that was back when I was using MS-DOS. Well, as a primary system. Long live FreeDOS, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
An open source, large drive friendly version of DOS. The only limitation, it seems, to be IDE-based. That is to say, it doesn't really handle modern SATA drives or whatnot. So it's either a net run under, you know, virtual something or other, or on hardware of a certain generation. My P1 loves it.
Well, also, Fady, years and years ago, the subject of them finding a Microsoft MO saying, yeah, we changed this one little thing and we can break FreeDOS and not have them as a competitor anymore.
Well, there's both a FreeDOS itself and then there's a Russian spin that contains more 32-bit oriented stuff. But for my 32 megabyte machine, there's very few Linux in that will work, and FreeDOS with appropriate hackery can actually be networked in that small of space.
And we all like keeping the old systems running.
Yes, unless somebody's got a bunch of 32 megabyte SIMs that I can replace my 8s with. I can't even put Tiny Core on it. I could probably try the Core, but that's pretty, that would be excruciating for me to try to install with my level of Linux knowledge. So building up from DOS is fine. Building down, not so much.
Okay, a couple things I found today, and this is just you know, not just general internet type stuff, not obviously not open source necessarily rated, but definitely for all of us who use computers. I didn't even know it was possible. I assume with consent from both parties, there is support in Google Maps for one party tracking the location of another party. And I don't know if I talked about this itself. Joel Gorkon, of course, he's a ham radio operator, and he brought his mobile ham radio. But with the ham radio, he, you know, he could bring in the stuff, put on Google Maps, because he was getting there after I and a few other people were. And so we could see his progress down the coast toward Charlotte. And I thought, oh, that is so cool. That's almost worth learning ham radio for. But, of course, you know, there's various things. Android apps do almost the same thing. I was thinking 4chan or something like that. You could probably do something like that, but apparently this is built into Google Maps. But you know, this is a link on Tom's hardware guide I saw today. It's sort of questioning. It also says, when you got all this connected in, the subject who you're watching move, you can see the battery level of their phone. And they were wondering exactly what level that would be. Maybe if you're tracking your kids and their phone's about to go dead or something like that. But it seemed to me this is probably something that just got opened up by mistake or accident, because I really can't see the legitimacy in broadcasting that.
Yeah, well, I've read the original stuff building the Honeywell computers, which ran the network links on the original ARPANET, and it could be somebody just got a phone API of some kind and just threw everything in like the kitchen sink, because they didn't really know what people were going to do with it, but they decided to make calls to all of the possible API points just in case somebody wanted to use them.
Well, this is what I'm imagining. Whatever API was implemented to do this, that just came along for the ride and nobody noticed it and shut it down.
Yeah. In the Honeywell case, they didn't know. They got a block diagram and they wired the computer to fit the block diagram instead of function, because he thought Honeywell would know how to hook up their own computers. So it was a real frustrating event. It's a lot easier to reprogram code than it is to reprogram wire wrap.
Right. And another one, another article from Tom's guide. And I think in this, they are maybe spreading a little bit of FUD, because everybody here is probably side-loaded F-Droid onto their phone, which is a completely open source way to get applications. I mean, analogous to the built-in Play Store, but everything you find on F-Droid is going to be completely open source, and there are a lot of people don't want to install stuff that might be closed source from the Play Store on their phone. They insist on only using open source, if possible. And so a lot of us at one time or another have enabled a setting called use unknown sources on Android to just sideload an APK file from a trusted place. And I thought from Tom's own article that we talked about a while back, in, I think it was on the putting the streaming service on a desktop thing, is essentially get anything bad on there, even with the install from unknown sources. You'd have to do a positive action to do it. It's not like you hit open and then everybody can sideload stuff on your device without your knowledge. I'll get that in a second. So that may or may not be true, but I think if you open it up long enough, get Fortnite installed, and then closed it off. And they talked about, well, maybe you can't do updates. They didn't verify whether or not Fortnite could continue to update with, you know, whether unknown sources was open or not. But I, like I said, I've known a lot of people use the unknown sources and not immediately become infected. So I think they're probably, better people speak to this to me, but I'm thinking even if that left open, you're just not opening yourself up to anything that could come floating along. Maybe I'm wrong. But I would think even if you had to wait, if Fortnite was calling for updates, you could wait for that to happen, then open it up temporarily, let it up, close it again, without really exposing yourself to every bad thing out there. So I am kind of excited, you know, that you don't have to buy an expensive console or a high-end gaming PC to run Fortnite. Well, you know, I haven't tried it on any of my devices. It might not run on any of the cheaper Android devices that I own. But it, you know, this if games like Fortnite are coming to, say, phones, and if there's a way to use the phone as a console into the TV, or if they're coming to the cheaper consoles like the if it runs on a console, it ought to run on a Switch, I would think. Or if it runs on a phone, it ought to run on a Switch. This may spell the death knell for the $5,000 gaming PC. So, which I'm not sure is good, necessarily a good thing, because I like the idea of still having a desktop PC to use, rather than everything going to an Android device. But I'll kick it out there. So does anybody think, sideloading apps, as long as you're just not grabbing stuff from places that you don't know who it is, you think that's really a threat to your Android device or not?
Well, I don't have one, but I suspect, just like not loading every PPA in the world if you're using Ubuntu, you know, you have to, networks have built, you know, safe software from the net requires having a certain amount of caution and a certain amount of understanding of where stuff is coming from and why.
And apparently Fortnite, or the developer Fortnite, Epic Games, has explained it's purely economic position on their part. And Fortnite is like a lot of these newer games. Sort of an in-game store for a bunch of stuff. You find out it's very hard to level up unless you're paying to level up. And like a lot of these modern games are, I believe that's the situation with Fortnite. Haven't played it yet. Might try it on Android now that it's there. So it's not just the initial cost, you know, you get in the game, especially, you know, want to be very careful giving this to young if they have access to try to, you know, make, do in-game purchases, because all of a sudden they've bought all this kind of ridiculous stuff and hundreds of dollars spent in-game, which a lot of people don't understand when they give their kids games. But, I think I forgot my point.
It's a freemium game, which means that you... They give you a free starter, but that's like a, you know, it's a pay to progress, as a friend of mine called the Mighty Jingles on YouTube says, because grinding through truly free levels when the other guy can pull out his virtual wallet and, you know, get a gun three times better than yours or what have you, gets tired fast.
Oh, I know what my point was going to be. The reason it's not on Android's Play Store is Android takes a 30% cut of everything you buy in the Play Store. And so they didn't want to give 30% of what they're charging for the game to Google.
Well, that sounds like a fairly substantial chunk. Or rather, it means that they would have to raise the cost of their game to cover what cost Google was passing on to them.
Right, and then that would probably make the cost of the game for Android substantially higher than it would be for PC or console. Be interested to see if now you can play. I think now the PC version and the console version you can play against each other. It'd be interested to see if Android is separate or if that's included. You know that all three platforms can play against each other. So because I know it's one of those games that every Fortnite is one of the biggest games out there right now. So, you can't do it on iPhone because you can't sideload stuff. Well, you can, but you got jailbreak phone, and most people aren't doing it anymore. It's harder than it used to be. So, I think it's interesting just to see where, you know, they're maybe saying, yeah, we're not, nobody's buying a $4,000 or $5,000 gaming PC anymore, and maybe nobody's buying consoles, and let's get this stuff running on the phones.
Well, the fact... my brother's phone, which is probably not top of the line, 8-core, 4 big, 4 little, and with the storage and whatnot, compared to some of the earlier consoles, that's probably fairly... Compared, you know, with the graphics processors and whatnot that they throw in, probably fairly comparable.
True, of course. The high-end phone is what, $700, even $800. Of course, you might expect it to be more powerful than a console or even many gaming PCs. However, you know, for that kind of money, well, probably not the gaming PCs, but definitely. Faster than $300 console. Of course, the $300 console is usually loss leader because they make their money on the games, not selling you the console. It's an interesting development and probably significantly cutting the GPU sales if this trend continues.
Well, there's. It seems like there's going to be a shrinking I should probably register the term real system market for those of us who want full-blown hardware, whether it's a laptop, desktop, or what have you. And then there's going to be more run this on your device, whether it's a phone or some other more the next generation console or what have you.
Well, a lot of these just free phone games look better than anything, you know, we had 5 years ago on either console or a PC. Now, I'm looking at the bottom article. Apparently, it is available for iOS, so they must just be taking that 30% chunk out of it. and it's been available on the Switch since June. So I might have to look at putting on the Switch. Apparently, it's Sony is not letting it cross over to PS4. It doesn't say anything here about PC, I guess. Or not in the same place. No, that may be why I haven't heard about getting it for PC, though my PC is not fast enough for any kind of modern games. And it looks like Kay Wisher and Jay Lindsay are over there in Hash Linux Lugcast, pounding on Botley, trying. I think it probably works for what it was, but I think they're trying to see if they can do anything or maybe not. But they're trying to get it to work over there, so. Good luck, guys. Let's see. This is interesting, this DAC board article on a do-it-yourself wall display. Now, this is not like a magic mirror sort of thing, though I imagine it could be used, but it's an RPI distro to build a magic wall and essentially just plug an RPI into... Well, they say display. I'm sure you could probably just use the way prices are going, it'd be probably just as cheap to use a TV as a dedicated than a dedicated display, HDMI display. Though you might get more resolution with the HDMI monitor for the same amount of money. But, so this is your magic wall. I think it is. I think the article said it could be voice activated if you added in the right stuff. But displays time, temperature, news, all that kind of stuff. So rather than having to roll your own, it's a distribution built to be a magic wall, from scratch, from the beginning. So you don't really have to do a whole lot of config to it.
Well, it sounds like I would like that because right now a lot of the stuff, the widgets around my desktop are for weather and whatnot. You know, general clocks and whatnot. So I have a big TV and I could plug that into one of the HDMI inputs and run that most of the time.
Right, because what this seems to add is your personal calendar, your meeting schedule, and a news feed, looks like, and a background. I'm sure it probably changes ground, and then weather report and all that.
Well, it sounds like also quite frankly, I don't use that large screen. Of course, well, it's a 1080p screen. I could just as easily get a second monitor that I set up on top of my, desktop that's HDMI and use that as a real monitor and then use the big wall display as sort of a billboard. An active billboard, like, so that I could have the news and I can have all the weather and all the other, sort of almost like TV, but not quite.
And let's talk here about Raspbian. So I don't know if I think there's both software that you install on Raspbian and a complete distro that. It's basically based on Raspbian. Let me look at the downloads and see.
Well, with the faster pseudo gigabyte on the new Raspberry Pis, just put another port on your Switch and away you go.
Right. I don't know how much bandwidth this would need if you weren't running video or something like that. I mean, since this is... Now, I'm certain you can use this landscape mode, what they show on the you know, what they show on the website has the monitor hung in portrait mode. So, you know, it wouldn't be as conducive to video in that mode as it would be in landscape. But, yeah, it seems to almost be a waste of a monitor if you couldn't also you could always plug Chromecast into another HDMI port and run it from there. But so it seems to be somebody needs to do something that integrates everything so that you wouldn't have to have one display for this and then have another display just to watch YouTube.
I think a lot of the rotation stuff depends on somebody getting into, you know, the display control in Raspbian or whatever, and telling it, nope, this is a landscape display, so behave landscape. Although I used to like the portrait display as a full page display.
Well, I don't know. Apparently what all this does is you're just running a browser and the stack board runs. Okay, the stack board runs in the browser. So looks like I don't see why you couldn't put this in any browser window.
Well, I suspect it's a it's like an Electron app. It's a pre-configured browser.
Maybe so. I might experiment with that. See if I could run that just in a browser window before next show.
Well, the whole idea is under those conditions, you can run that in whatever real estate it doesn't use, you can use as a regular display for whatever.
Yeah, that's possible.
And it does seem to soak up all of the little widgetry that you want, you know, calendar or date and time and temperature, weather report.
Yeah, it also, you know, looks like you're creating your own personal web page on their site, which would be where you'd probably configure, you know, what I want on my to show on my screen. But does that mean, you know, it incorporates, say, your Google Calendar? Or I mean, this is the trouble with having these different locales. I mean, I could add stuff to my Google Calendar with my Google Mini, or add stuff to my shopping list from my Google Mini, but it's not the same shopping list, and it's not the same calendar that I would access with the Echo that I bought. And this thing looks like it's maybe a whole third thing, because there's going to be people say, what, this talks to my Google Calendar? No, I don't want to give my Google password. So it's probably you've got a DAC board calendar. So, you know, if that's, yeah, that would be a bit of a problem. If the only place you could access your calendar was from this display on the side of your living room, and once you leave the house, you can't see your calendar anymore.
Well, the thing that I'm looking at is that it requires going out, you know, it just can't. It requires that things are running on the DAC server somewhere in the world, if I'm interpreting what you're saying right. If it was purely local intelligence, that would be different.
Yeah, that would sort of be my concern. I would think there's better ways to run a magic, you know, unless you just didn't want to bother doing anything. There might be, looking at this, there might be better ways to running a magic mirror and having your stuff internalized, or if not a magic mirror, a wall display. Because you would think to work, you would have to access the that DAC service from, you know, just a regular web page, just so you get your calendar all in one place, or more in one place, rather.
And the fact that it can hook up to a standard calendar, I mean, you know, you can't plug it into Thunderbird or whatever, or, you know, something that Thunderbird can read, WebDAV or what have you. running on a local server just is a deal breaker for anyone who has security issues.
Exactly. Okay. Well, we'll throw that out there for, I mean, I might play with it some. I mean, not build obviously the whole wall thing, but if I could get it on a regular web page, might play with the server some and report more on it. But yeah, I would think with most people with a higher level of technical acuity, that the convenience and the security issues might be off-putting. Okay, I had a couple things that are very much related with drones. Of course, you know, again, this is not strictly open source, but we have talked some about the drone hobby on this show. Remember a couple years ago, FAA came up with a whole bunch of rules on operating drones, and if it was, you know, above 5 ounces, then you had to register it and write the registration number on the side, and and various other things and operation, and you couldn't operate it beyond line of sight like you used to be able to do. And I think that one's still stuck, but the FAA was sued by hobbyist John Taylor, and as it was going through the courts, it pretty much blocked all those FAA regulations. And recently the Court of Appeals earlier this month pretty much sided with the FAA on everything.
That's interesting, because one of the channels that I watch on YouTube is called The Aerial Viewpoint, and that's what he does, is strictly, you know, he's got a fairly sophisticated drone and camera set up, and he's keeping an eye on a dam removal project near his home.
And I don't know, it says Congress reinstated the registry months later. I hadn't heard. I mean, last thing I reported was this guy won in court. The thing is, a lot of it on the other side of the big money, Alphabet, a.k.a. Google, and Amazon. A lot of Amazon wants to do their delivery service, so they want to regulate hobbyist drones so the airspace is open for them to go fly around their commercial delivery drones. It is essentially where this comes from. One of the things was you couldn't fly drones over a crowd. I think that's stuck. I guess FAA may release that one, but they're going to require most or all devices to identify themselves with essentially IFF. Does he be grandfathered? I mean, probably my drone that I have, which is at least halfway short, it's I don't know if it'd be grandfathered, but out here in a rural area, I don't think they're going to go after me. But anybody flying drones in a populated area, things are going to get a lot more complicated. And maybe some very expensive drones that you've bought or built are not going to be qualified for flight anymore. So this is something to look at. Also, the second article, NASA is actually coming up with, you know, sort of flight control systems for drones. Again, mainly so that you know, your so-called delivery drones, which do not exist yet, could fly in an area with impunity without having to worry about running into hobbyist drones. So any drone that you have is going to have to, you know, be connected to a network so that they can't. A lot of drones, the DJI ones and things like that I have, you know, pretty much there's areas of blocked airspace. Some cities you can't fly a drone at all. And, you know, most of your airports, even though private strips, are marked on a map. And you wouldn't be able to, like, friend down the road that had a private airplane. But, you know, his little dirt strip is marked And if I were to take my drone and try to fly over that, I don't think it would. Certainly the newer ones I don't think would. But looks like now they're all going to have some kind of radio. So they're all networked, and FAA can tell where you are at all times, or maybe a mesh network of some kind. Because I would think, you know, that kind of connectivity, you'd only be able possible to do it during the city, you know. But maybe if you had a mesh network so that if two drones were flying in the same area, they could talk to each other and say, hey, I'm here and you're there. Don't fly into each other. Something like that could be worked out.
Well, it's going to be IFF type stuff. Identify friend, foe. I mean, I've looked a little bit at software-defined radio, and already airliners have a lot of they squawk their ID, their rate, speed, altitude, all that stuff. What they're basically saying is that every drone with these new regulations is going to have to be outfitted like a commercial airliner.
Exactly, and one wonders, you know, how heavy that equipment is going to be, or wouldn't be, is going to be prohibitively expensive, would it even be possible, you know, to mount something like that with any kind of range on a camera drone. Of course, you know, if the Wi-Fi, supposedly they had a 5-mile range or whatever, you know, just using Wi-Fi to communicate with a tablet. So I guess one could argue that if they can do that, they can certainly create a mesh network and talk to each other and keep from colliding. So I don't know. Maybe it won't be too prohibitive, but it, like I said, it may be something that can't be. Maybe it could be retrofitted by software. You already got a radio there working, or a firmware upgrade. I don't know. It's going to be interesting seeing if all of a sudden, yeah, we've passed these new regulations and now all your existing drones are illegal. Or if you try, you know, if you try to register one with the FAA, they say, nope, that one's too old. We won't register it. Sorry, you can't fly it.
Well, as I said, in Massachusetts, the legislature, you know, couldn't, which probably most of them couldn't tell an Uzi from a cup of Uzo, have decided that certain guns have military purposes only as defined by the legislature, and these are now non-transferable, non-saleable. They're basically bricks. You can't use them, you can't move them. Owning them is illegal. They have given them no grandfather clauses, no nothing. If this is the kind of legislation we're talking about here with the FAA regulations, there could be millions of dollars of drones that are suddenly paperweights.
Right. I hope that doesn't happen. Or, like I said, probably in rural areas, they're not going to come looking for you. But, you know, and you know, to fly it, would I have to, you know, there were parts of it, you know, there were drones in the hands of real estate agents, and they were taking pictures of houses or whatever. In fact, quite a few. And just about everybody on YouTube that takes, you know, that travels and takes pictures of stuff seems to have a drone now. And a lot of those people, that's, you know, they're actually making their money off YouTube. You know, contributions through YouTube, and you know, that's their business, to travel around and do things and take pictures and show people what they're doing, because people don't have time to go travel for themselves. So, you know, a lot of things, you know, one of the things back then that the FAA was saying, well, you know, you can't use a drone for a commercial purpose unless you have it registered for commercial purposes, and then we are going to, you know, we're going to charge you for that privilege, you know. So, and you know, there's businesses around here. I probably waited too long. So somebody was telling me somebody already was in the business. You know, a lot of things that would have been done by aerial surveys and stuff in agriculture, doing that with drones now. So I'd heard about that a year or two ago, or read an article on it, and thought about getting into the business and drug my heels on that. So maybe probably somebody else is already doing it here. You know, so that, you know, a whole bunch of things that if what's a hobbyist purpose and what's a commercial purpose? And
many of the channels that I follow on YouTube, where it's farming channels even, or whatever, construction, whatever they're doing, they have a drone that they set out so that, you know, they can get the aerial view of whatever operation that they're doing, whether it's a farming or land clearing or whatever.
Oh yeah, it just seems to be one of those things. Like 20 years ago, you know, being connected to the internet maybe was unusual. Well, I don't know about unusual. 20 years ago, certainly 25 probably, and now, you know, you can't, without an internet connection, you can't do business. And I'm thinking it's getting that way with drones, and probably if they start soaking too many people with taxes, there will be, you know, a backlash that'll be heard by the government. But the other thing was that, you know, NASA was tasked with, you know, kind of building this mesh network, which we've talked about, that they're working on, you know, a sort of flight automated flight control system for drones when you get in some sort of congested area. You know, if I were to do this business where I was, you know, surveying farmland or whatever, and a lot of that was, I think, with fixed wing type aircraft, not the just the drones you used to go out and buy. But I said, how would that work with, say, the aerial sprayers who would probably work at about the same altitude? I mean, I guess one of the regulations is you're not supposed to go above 400 feet for any reason anymore with a drone. And I think even aerial sprayers are supposed to stay above that, but I know when they're down on the crops, they aren't. So, you know, there'd be too, and I don't know what hitting a drone would do to one of those aircraft. Probably not much, but, you know, so I was kind of thinking towards that. Well, if I get in that business, then I'm going to want to coordinate my efforts with those sprayers and say, hey, are you going to be in this area today? And if you are, I'll wait till the next day to do my stuff or something like that.
And also 400 feet over what?
You know, because I've seen guys fly under power lines at the end of the field rather than go over them. So that's definitely not 400 feet.
I'm just saying I have a lot of terrain features here where in 50 feet, there may be a difference in terrain of 50 feet.
Right. Your drone doesn't like have look down radar to, you know, to judge that. So it's going to be 400 feet from the origin point.
Well, 400 feet, yeah, but I'm just saying, you know, so I'm up here in hilly New England, and if I want to look at the top of the hill, I have to go up, you know, 50 feet, 75, whatever. And I'm sure that there are parts of my town where the elevations are considerably different. So 400 feet, is that a vertical, or 400 feet over terrain?
In a lot of places, that's not even going to clear buildings.
Yeah. Yeah, trying to get anything around, let's say, Boston. That's going to be a problem. And, you know, we have buildings. We have the Beacon Hill slope and everything. People are going to want to keep an eye on stuff. But it sounds like they're just trying to reserve the airspace for or give people special permits for higher airspace.
Yeah, like I said, the whole thing controlled by a bunch of old people who, you know, never don't understand why anybody would be interested in this kind of sport. Though, you know, these same regulations are going to hit the model aircraft industry. And that is a whole bunch of, you know, usually older people that I've seen with money to spend. So that's going to, you know, that's probably one segment of people who will be heard if these regulations become so odious that nobody can fly anything.
Well, I have a feeling this is going to be one of those things that until enough oxes get gored, the FAA is going to say, oh yeah, this is wonderful and fine. And when they try to implement it, I mean, this reminds me a lot of the old-fashioned CB radio licensing, which they tried to tighten down on, and they found there were so many radios that they couldn't enforce a ham radio type licensing system. It just didn't work.
Oh yeah, I remember when we first got our radios, you know, you had to begin every time you start talking with your call letters, and that, of course, that had to be registered with the FCC. And probably about 10 years after that, they just dropped that whole thing. So, no, just buy your radio. And they did keep enforcing, you know, boosting the power, you know, because a lot of people would do that and then would blanket a whole. Well, like our friend the spammer here the other day. You know, you would have somebody come on the channel, just get the whole channel where nobody would talk, and that, you know, they'd be three states away, so there'd be no point. And all they were doing is they were, you know, they were seeing how far they could get, you know, if they're boosted radio. In other words, they're frustrated ham guys that didn't want to bother, you know, getting the license or well, I shouldn't say that. I mean, that's an insult to ham guys. It's guys who want to do ham radio type stuff without, you know, getting licensed or anything like that. So, and was absolutely no point in it.
There were people who believed that their credit card gave them enough license.
Exactly. Okay. Believe it or not, I'm about winding down. Well, I mentioned this one before. I'll just see if there's anything in the article we want to talk about, but where I said earlier with fake news that Gizmodo has this article that says that the, you know, people are making fake videos that are almost impossible to tell from the real thing. And they're calling them deep fakes. See, well, I guess there was a video of Obama that's hard to tell from the real thing created at the University of Washington last year. Doesn't look like they're showing us the software or the hardware needed to create it. Let me scroll down. And there's a lot of videos in the article. Okay, now one thing they talk about, you know, they talk about one person and then they map somebody else's face over that. And that's kind of like, you know, they did Moff Tarkin in Rogue One. And Princess Leia, but it's interesting, you know, they're doing this, you know, they'll run on consumer hardware so that, you know, they have like a male actor and then paint female face over it and have the output look realistic. So in other words, facial expressions or whatever, they can't do that on the computer. You have an actual actor doing it. But then the mapping software is good enough. It looks like somebody completely different is there on the screen. They do say currently there's a lot of artifacts, which experts can look at the video and tell if it's been faked, but they're not sure how long that's going to be true. Let's see. Talk about even, you know, it's being used for adult sorts of things. So, I would assume that would mean that, you know, everybody's seen the faked stills of celebrities or whatever, and I guess it would be that you they could do that with video now. And that's really all the article says. It doesn't say how to do it, where to go, you know, get the hardware and software. But it's, you know, it's getting, well, certainly within our lifetimes, it's going to be scarily easily to put somebody in a compromising situation on video where it's not real, and that I'm certain is going to be the next level of fake news. All right, that was the last link I had. Does anybody have something they want to add?
Well, my link's already been covered. Thank you, gentlemen.
And I think Honky's talked about his stuff. Honky, you still there? We haven't heard from you in a while.
Yeah, I'm still here. I kind of faded out for a little while. Sorry. Been up since 3 a.m.
Yeah, sorry about that. I probably do go on.
No, it's fine. Just had to get up real early this morning for work.
Well, you make sense, so it's not as, it's actually worthwhile.
Well, thank you. I had to bring a few links that I thought might be interesting since I haven't done any projects. I'm really going to make an effort in the next 2 weeks to actually do some real projects I can talk about.
Did you get that single board computer that you were going to try to use as a firewall that you had the serial network adapters to it? Adapters, what am I thinking of?
Well, it had four RJ45, but they were connected to the serial bus, not to the network. I think it was Netmeyer saying, yeah, those could be, you know, slow network connections. I think probably what I'm going to do is save it for, I think I'll, you know, I don't think my R server is fast enough to run a camera network when I get it, security camera network when I get it set up. So I'll probably save it for that or something else that is going to need a faster system and look for, you know, a similar computer that actually has two or more network ports on it. I did look at the that distribution you mentioned last time, Honky, but they don't have a version for my banana Pro router. And actually, I looked at distros for the Banana Pro router, and the only thing that's been updated in the last year is Arch, which I don't know if that's a desktop distribution or it's, you know, Arch configured as a router somehow. I rather it's just a distribution intended for a regular Banana Pro, Banana Pi Pro, that happens to run on this hardware. But I may look into that because, when my internet went, I mentioned you guys, I don't think I mentioned on the show that the internet was down from Saturday to Wednesday, and it was because the lightning took it out on the ISP side. Though, you know, I called them Saturday night, it was late, you know, it was after midnight, so I got first level support, and they said, well, they couldn't check the, you you know, they couldn't actually get into hardware to see which end it was on, but they said they didn't think there was an outage. And Sunday, I was a little under the weather, time I got to town Monday, bought a different router because they said, well, you might try a different router in there before you call us back. And my spare router didn't work when I hooked it up, so went to town, got another one, and hooked it up. Still couldn't get in, and it was after 5 o'clock when I finally called them, and they couldn't. I said, we can't check it on your end because, you know, we're only first level. I mean, they hired guns. And then they called me the next day and said, no, you're included. One of our transmitters got zapped, and it took – this was Wednesday. Or no, it was Tuesday they called me back and said, yeah, we've been looking for days for somebody to climb the tower. I guess they don't have anybody here that could climb the tower. Or they don't have anybody full time. They got to hire somebody when something gets zapped on the tower. So I'm thinking of changing ISPs at my first opportunity now, because it sounded like, oh yeah, if we couldn't have found anybody, you would have been just out of luck. So that's my sob story for the week. And you know, if there's an ISP can't even service their own equipment, I've got an alternative. I'm thinking I may well go with it, but so I bought an extra router and was playing with that this week. And I was going to say, it's a Netgear. What is it? I've got the box here, don't I? It's like the lowest level, or cheapest one I could get, because the difference was really the speed of the Wi-Fi. And I've got my Wi-Fi on an access point anyway. Yeah, an AC750. And I was going to complain about how bad it was because I couldn't even at first change the home address on the router, which was ridiculous. But I didn't know if there was a simple and an advanced mode, and I thought I had it in advanced mode. But if you get one of these, you know, proactively click on the tab for advanced mode, because it looks like it's selected, but it's not. And then all of a sudden I could get to these stuff where I could turn off the wireless radios, and I could I could set the home address of the router, and that, you know, which fixed a bunch of my problems. But you know, like I said, I took them a few days to get reconnected. And so at that time I was thinking about, well, you know, like I said, I've been wanting to do another PS since box, but Banana Pro router that I got a few years ago, its router software I don't think has been updated since then. So maybe that means it's fully baked and doesn't need to be, but I rather suspect it's just nobody's working on it.
Well, with OpenWRT, I mean, if it's compatible with if OpenWRT is compatible with its processor architecture, then it should just pretty much be able to run, or you should be able to find an updated copy of it, whether it's taking that one and updating it, or I think in the past I had actually compiled it on my own, where it's basically just a bunch of checkboxes as to what you want to include it onto it, and then compile it for your, I think it's just the all-winner CPU architecture, and then it should just basically run.
Well, I may try it again before I buy new hardware then, because it was OpenWRTs. I remember the problem last time was not getting OpenWRT installed. I just could never find the default username and password for that version of OpenWRT for some reason. It's probably out there by now.
Right.
So I'll make another pass at this before I go buy something else, I think. But, you know, some people may think, well, an ARM processor isn't going to be fast enough, but no more throughput than I have, I don't think it'll be a problem.
What, the ARM processor is fast enough as a firewall?
Yeah, I think hadn't we discussed that? Somebody was saying they didn't think ARM was fast. Well, of course, it's got to be faster, or as fast, than whatever's in a commercial router.
Right, exactly. Right, I think we did talk about that, because I think Tony Bemis and Kevin were both talking about how they had built theirs out of like very small 32-bit systems. But those were their firewalls.
Okay, well, I think that's all we had. Do you want to end the show, K-Wisher? Honky Magoo, Jay Lindsay, are you still listening out there?
Yeah, I'm still here. It's great joining you guys. It's always fun listening.
Well, great having you, man. And, you know, as long as we don't have the stream up, don't forget you can always come listen to us here. And join in when you can. We always love hearing from you.
Absolutely. All right, this has been episode 107. Let's see. Our next recording date is August 17th, 2018. Our music is Downright, provided by Klaatu and Brome. We want to thank Tony Bemis from the Sunday Morning Linux Review for basically getting us up off the ground and running, and for everything else he's done for us. We want to thank Delwyn for providing the Mumble server, and for providing the bot module. As long as Botley gets back up, which it looks like he is, all you have to do is type .ns in the IRC command line, and it will tell you the next show recording date. I have been Honky Magoo. With me tonight has been 5150.
Stay classy, planet Earth.
Jay Lindsay.
Good night, everyone.
And, of course, Netminer.
Take care. Good night, all.
Good evening, Netminer.
How do I sound?
Beautiful.
I prefer handsome, thank you.
Yes. All right, that link I put in there sucks. Hold on.
Excuse me, am I in the wrong channel? There's people here at 9 o'clock.
Well, I'm here, but I'm usually here. At least I like to think I am. Yeah, that's a better link to the show notes. Evening, 50.
Goodness, 50. I don't know which is more shocking, seeing a couple of people here at virtually 9 o'clock. Or seeing a groundhog sitting on my doorstep this morning.
Did you get a picture?
Get a picture. I just hope we don't have 6 more weeks of this heat.
I was hoping some bread that was getting, not moldy yet, but dry. I can't eat bread fast enough to finish a loaf. And broke it up through out in front of my windows, hoping maybe get some good bird pictures, but haven't seen any yet.
Do we still do a stream?
We apparently aren't right now. Doesn't Father Finch usually set that up?
Yeah, and I can't remember whether we've had one in the last couple of shows. But then again, well, the only people I knew who were ever listening to the stream was K-Wisher and Jay Lindsay.
Well, if there's only that many people getting on, it's probably, probably would be nice if one of us or both of us figured out how to do that. So we could have, we could have a stream no matter who had the time to show up. But if it's only 2 people listening, probably it's not priority. It has to get done before next show.
Nobody's complained so far. Not sure if that's good or bad.
Just restarting Firefox because it was getting, so you leave it running for several days, it gets sluggish. We'll see. I might have to reboot the whole system to get speed back, but I think I'm probably good. Apologize, I haven't accomplished anything noteworthy in the last 2 weeks. My excuse is going to be I was out of internet for several days.
That's all right. The only, I've been bashing my head against the wall trying to get one thing done, and then I just found my one topic for tonight is the one quick little thing that just automatically did what I wanted it to do. If you remember, I was talking about the trying to use xdo tool to try to get the use the keyboard to simulate basically to work as a like the left mouse click, so I can actually like use it to drag and drop. And I tried to use xdo tool and some other things, but I finally found something that worked. And yeah, after trying to run all this other stuff, what I try to use xdo tool and what was the name of the other one? Auto key, which is supposed to be kind of like auto hotkey, which also makes it very difficult anytime you try to do a Google search for anything related to auto key, because all I get is a bunch of links to auto hotkey, which is a Windows application that does the exact same thing, but it works differently.
Did we have listener feedback? I saw somebody start posting about Kay Wisher, and because I looked, I didn't see anything in the G Plus group.
He just posted something about 48 minutes ago. Something about, he says, getting ready to pull the trigger on the required parts to replace the failed controller on a printer I acquired. And he has a link to, I'll put the link into it. Let me finish putting this in here.
Okay, I wonder if that wasn't new. We'll talk about this when we get to it. I'm kind of surprised that there's any kind of printer that it's worth buying parts and fixing.
Yeah, I'm just reading about the attempt to convert GCC's SVN storage to Git. Sounds like another OS 360 problem.
I guess I hadn't heard anything about that. Do you want to post a link?
If somebody could make me a segment, that would be nice.
What, in the show notes?
Yes.
Just put your name in, man.
Well, it's in just above Honky.
Yeah, I saw that. Got the link open. Well, we'll wait till the show starts for real, because it's something interesting. Most interesting thing is that Eric Raymond is apparently hosting GCC on his home server. Oh, okay. 3D printer in Kay Wisher's case. That makes more sense.
Why? Do you think it was a regular printer?
Well, you said printer.
Oh, sorry.
It's like an other than a high-end laser printer. What kind of printer would be worth repairing these days?
Well, it looks like, reading the article, he wants to replace the controller board with a ARM board. It talks about switching it out with a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Also eliminate having to plug the thing into a Pi. I guess you do need both. It says the Pi is... Well, no, we'll wait till we get to the show. I'm sorry. So, if all the links are in the notes, are we ready to go?
Yes, I think so. Want me to host?
Well, as I recall, I did it last time.
Alrighty. Give me a sec.
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence. On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday Morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio-only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
Oh my god, it's Hacker Public Radio! Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, and that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net, / tech show. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Blindridge, he's a bloody drunko.
If you don't like the gas, you can get up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that'll get back.